Russian devotees. People are, even after they get Prabhupada's books, they still have all these doubts that we have to deal with. Like Prabhupada's talking about administrative demigods. That's a big no-no in the modern academia. That the anthropologists consider extremely primitive, that the lightning is produced by a personality, that the rainfall, the wind, that's, they say that the aborigines in the jungle, they have this conception that the aborigines, they portray them as very crude and primitive, and they look up and they hear a thunderbolt and then they begin offering obeisances. So we're really in trouble with this. If devotees are kind of isolated, they're not really in touch with how academia or intellectuals think at universities, or even normal people would hesitate to accept these kinds of things. That they're actually, that the wind and rain is under the control of a person, that's very primitive. That's like Zeus and all the Greek demigods and all the primitive, that's all been thrown out by modern science, supposedly. So we have a huge amount of work to do. It's a massive challenge, actually. In April 2nd, 1977, Prabhupada wrote three letters to senior disciples saying that Bhaktivedanta Institute is now one of our most important preaching tools. He wrote to Bhaktisroop Damodar Maharaj, who he put in charge. He was getting a PhD in chemistry at University of California, Irvine. He was put in charge of the Bhaktivedanta Institute. Prabhupada said, you should go from university to university to challenge and defeat. In Sanskrit, it's called Digvijaya. We know the pastime of Keshava Kashmiri from the Adi Lila chapter 16 of Chaitanya Charitamrita. This very puffed up scholar came to challenge Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya completely annihilated him. Lord Chaitanya was the greatest scholar of his time. He defeated Prakashananda Saraswati, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and Keshava Kashmir, and they were the three greatest scholars of India. So after Lord Chaitanya did that, he was established. His name was Nimai Pandit in the beginning. Vishvambara or Nimai Pandit were the two names of Lord Chaitanya when he was young. So he went around. In his early days, he would just, because they were so puffed up, he wanted to teach them a lesson. These were really puffed up people. They would just go around. This Digvijaya, Dig means directions and Vijaya means conquer, one who's conquered all directions. So he would carry a Jayapatra, a paper, and after he had annihilated his opponent in debate, he forced him to sign on the paper. So he would go around bragging about all the scholars he had defeated. This was standard program, actually. There was one, Rup Narayan, he was another Digvijaya a little earlier on. He went to challenge Rup and Sanatan Goswami in Vrindavan. So this Rup Narayan came in, he was so puffed up. And Rup and Sanatan, being pure devotees, they were very humble. And they had enough scriptural knowledge, of course, to defeat him easily. But they didn't want to waste their time, so they just signed. So, yes, we agree, you defeated us. Now have a nice day. Please go somewhere else. Then this Rup Narayan was so audacious, he was so arrogant that he went to Jiva Goswami, who was the disciple of Rup and Sanatan. Jiva Goswami is considered the greatest literary genius in our sampradaya. He wrote more than 400,000 verses. The Bhagavatam is 18,000, so he wrote 20 times more than the Bhagavatam. He was an absolute genius. Of course, they're all empowered, but specifically Jiva Goswami was a great literary figure in our sampradaya. So he's also exalted, they're all pure devotees. All the Goswamis are exalted Nityasiddha, associates of Radha and Krishna. But Jiva Goswami, he didn't take the humble point at this point because he was so angry that this scholar had Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami sign. So he challenged him and he completely wiped up the floor with him. He just annihilated him left and right. Completely smashed him royally. But then Rupa Goswami said, you are too proud. You do not deserve to reside in Sri Vrindavan Dham. So he was exiled for 1 year, Jiva Goswami. And what did he do? He didn't protest with folded... Although he did the right thing, Prabhupada said, because he was defending the honor of his guru. It wasn't his own personal honor in debate. He couldn't tolerate that Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami had been so-called defeated by this rascal. So he did the right thing, actually, but Rupa Goswami wanted to even bring him to a higher standard of ultimate humility. It's mainly to teach us. Actually, they're all in the... Jiva Goswami, all these people are totally purified, all these pure devotees in our lineage. They have no tinge of materialism, all of these Goswamis. So what Jiva Goswami was exiled, he had to live outside Vrindavan, and he lived in a cave, and he ate only raw flour. He didn't cook, he mixed it with water, just a handful of raw flour every day for a whole year. He was so sincere, he was doing penance and praying constantly for Rupa and Sanatan to forgive him. We might last 1 week. I doubt we could even go 1 week on that diet. And he was totally enlivened. It was not that he was feeling this is a heavy austerity. He was so devoid of the desire for honor and sense gratification. Sense gratification takes two nefarious styles, either gross or subtle. And if you turn off the gross, then the subtle begins to operate. Or if you shut off the subtle, then the gross comes into play. But a conditioned soul cannot avoid sense gratification. He must indulge in gratifying his senses because that's his whole point in life. His life and soul is to imitate Krishna, and Krishna is the enjoyer. So Jiva Goswami was so exalted, he just ate this. If you take some flour right out of the bag, just this white flour, it's utterly tasteless, and mix it with a little water, and that's all he had for a whole year. And he was living underground, praying and begging and calling out. And one day Sanatan Goswami came by and saw him doing these horrendous and difficult austerities. And he went back to Rupa Goswami and said, please forgive him, please call him back. One of our principles is Jiva Doya, which means mercy to the jivas, compassion to the souls in general, but in this case specifically to Jiva Goswami. So he was called back to Sri Vrindavan Dham. So our lineage actually consists of great scholarly personalities. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was considered the lion guru. He couldn't tolerate, whenever Mayavadis would come within range, he would run over and say, why are you cheating the people with this impersonal philosophy? He would challenge them on the spot. They became afraid of him. He was like a lion. Prabhupada said, devotees should be like a lamb at home and like a lion on the chase. If you're like a lion at home and a lamb on the chase, you're in deep trouble. If you're aggressive with the devotees and always asking everyone to serve you, and then you're in big trouble. So it has to be, at home amongst the Vaishnavas, we should be like a lamb, very humble. But when it comes to defending the honor of the Sampradaya or eliminating misconceptions that impede people's taking to the process of bhakti yoga, such as impersonal philosophies, we should be as aggressive as a lion. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was actually a genius. He had a photographic memory. When he was 7 years old, he had memorized the entire Bhagavad Gita, every single verse, and could give learned discourses on it at age 7. By age 11, he had memorized many shastras. So one time, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was scheduled to give a lecture, and he became sick by Krishna's arrangement. So he knew Krishna's making an arrangement, so he sent his son, who was only 11 years old, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And he went to the meeting, and the Mayavadis tried to restrict him. They said, we do not allow in this debate any references to Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita. They thought to eliminate all Vaishnava scriptures and left him with only one obscure Upanishad. And he proceeded to annihilate them in debate. And the Upanishads can generally be read in an impersonalistic way. They appear like that. If you read, even in Isha Upanishad, he walks, but he does not walk. He has no legs, but he walks faster than everyone else. So the impersonalists love these kind of, for them, it's right up their alley. Of course, later on, it says, oh Lord, please remove your dazzling effulgence so I can see your mukha, your face. So that kind of makes a big problem for the impersonalistic interpretation. But that Isha Upanishad is one of the culminations. So the earlier Upanishads, they're generally meant to bring people, the jnanis and impersonalists, gradually towards Krishna. So they really do superficially appear to be impersonal. Actually, they're trying to get people to be personal in their worship, to recognize the personality of Godhead. So when the Mayavadis had restricted Srila Bhaktisiddhanta to one obscure Upanishad, they felt confident that he won't be able to say anything about Vishnu or Krishna. Now we've got him cornered. We can defeat him. But no, he was so expert. So Vaishnavas are really good at debate. Although Vaishnavas are actually not interested in debate, Because we just want to chant the holy name of Krishna, ecstatic love of God. That's our actual, that's our personal goal, is to experience ecstatic love of God. But along with it, if you just analyze impartially the history of Vaishnavism, especially our Sampradaya, then Vaishnavas are extremely expert in logic and reasoning, and debating. And that's why Bhagavad Gita is full of Sambandha Gyan, all kinds of analysis. It's called Sambandha Gyan. All kinds of analysis. So analysis is very valuable. First, to convince yourself, if you're not swimming in ecstatic love day and night, then you have your mind to deal with, then you have to defeat your mind by these logical analyses. Once you reach the stage of bhakti, jnana is only good to bring you to the stage of bhakti. So jnana is good for yourself and for preaching to others. So therefore, there's a lot of emphasis on jnana. And if we go to universities, we will be challenged now by these modern jnanis, they take shelter of scientific analyses. And one of the theories they bring up, because Prabhupada is mentioning the purport about universal controllers and administrative demigods, one of the major challenges we have is what's called the multiverse theory. This is what the atheists bring up. This is their favorite weapon. And they say that although the probability of the self-organization of matter is exceedingly small, for example, 10 to the minus 500th power. Does everyone appreciate what 10 to the minus 500th power means? If you have like 1 over 10, 1/10, so 1 out of 10 is 1/10, and 1 out of 100 is even much smaller. That's one order of magnitude smaller. 100 is one order of magnitude greater than 10. So they use the term order of magnitude, each power of 10. So 100 is a lot smaller than 1/10, and 1,000 is even much smaller than 100th, and 1/10,000th is even much smaller. But 1/10,000th is only 10 to the minus 4. 1,000,000th is 10 to the minus 6. 1,000,000,000 is 10 to the minus 9. So you can imagine 10 to the minus 500th power. It's about as close to zero as you can get without saying zero. But so here's the difficulty. If you go through, and we haven't even gotten to the stage of calculating what it would take for matter to self-organize. See, we're way behind in our preaching, to be quite honest, to be brutally or starkly honest. In the field of intellectual preaching, we are very much behind. Prabhupada gave the order in 73. He set up this Bhaktivedanta Institute. And in 77, he wrote letters funding it, demanding massive funding from the BBT. On April 2nd, 1977. But we haven't done it. It simply has not been done. Devotees tried to do it, but it's extremely difficult. And I'll begin to give some insight into why it's difficult. First you have to go through and make the calculation, what it would take for matter to organize itself. And that involves physics and chemistry. It involves the properties of matter. This is purely a question of what matter can or cannot do. It has nothing to do with religion. Can matter organize itself into a bacterium, for example? I don't know if anyone appreciates how complicated a bacterium is. A single cell organism, like an E. coli bacterium, millions of which are now in your intestines helping you digest. There's millions of E. coli bacteria. This is one of the simplest of all creatures, but it is so sophisticated, it's described that it's more sophisticated than New York City. All the interactions going on within it per second are it's more going on there than an entire giant city like New York City. For example, a genome means the total DNA of this E. coli bacteria is 4.5 million bases, nucleotides. DNA is, of course, a long chain polymer of nucleotides. And every 3 nucleotides codes for 1 amino acid in a protein. Proteins are the doers. They're the machinery that actually does stuff in a cell. But proteins can't synthesize themselves. They need nucleic acids to explain how to put them together. And the ribosome is the workbench. It's also super complicated. The ribosome is not only composed of proteins, but also RNA. So it itself is a factory, like an automobile factory. It's super sophisticated, the ribosome, where the messenger RNA comes in, and every 3 nucleotides specifies 1 amino acid in a protein. And what comes off of the ribosome is a protein. Proteins typically have 300 or 400 amino acids, and they're like machines, very sophisticated machines that do things. in the cell. So it's unbelievably complex. This is the simplest cell. Each one of your cells, which is called a eukaryotic cell, is hundreds of times more complicated than this bacteria. And there are billions of cells in your body. There's more than 10 billion brain cells alone. And each of these brain cells is hundreds of times more sophisticated than this E. coli bacterium, which is itself more sophisticated than all the activity going on in a major city such as New York. So everyone, the atheists will flat out agree, yes, the probability of an E. coli bacterium coming about from a primordial soup. See, they start with a primordial soup. It would not be very tasty, I guarantee you. But that's what they call it, primordial soup. If you read, I don't know if anyone reads these things, but that's what they call it, primordial soup. A 10-kilometer deep global ocean. Global means covering the entire earth. And in it, you would find, according to Miller's experiment, which was performed in 1950, he was at University of Chicago, even. And he took a reducing atmosphere, just very simple things like ammonium, hydrogen gas, methane, and water vapor, and put it in a flask and shot a lightning bolt through electric discharge. And he found there were amino acids floating in the solution just from the electric discharge. And the atheist, this is a very famous experiment, Miller's experiment. I suppose everyone has heard of Miller's, I guess not. Miller's, you'll have to deal, if you go to university, and Prabhupada wanted us to preach to university students, by the way, because they're going to be the next senators and the next businessmen. They'll be the big shots in society, and they're the ones who are screwing up everything. They're the ones who are leading people down the wrong path. So we do actually have to preach to intellectuals, although we have not done it yet. It is part of the Dharma that Prabhupada wanted. There are many letters. The book distributors should go just do their thing. Don't divert your attention for a moment. But if your mind is very active and you like this kind of things, then science preaching is another way to get a large amount of mercy from Prabhupada. So Miller's experiment created a revolution in 1953. Another thing happened in 1953 is Watson and Crick discovered the double helical structure of DNA. I suppose everyone has heard of Watson and Crick and the double helical structure of DNA. The double helix. It looks like a submarine staircase, a circular staircase. And every three steps, it's made out of nucleotides. Every three nucleotides codes for one amino acid in a protein. So the theists have not really met up to the challenge, because the atheists say, first of all, the atheists say, we have not even calculated what is the actual probability of a bacterium coming about. That requires vast knowledge of chemistry, even more than anyone has on the Earth planet today, just even to figure out what the probability would be. And even after you get the figure, suppose one fine day you calculate it and it's 10 to the minus 500th power. And even the atheists agree to that. Everyone is forced to accept because your analysis is so erudite. What will they say? They'll say there's 10 to the 500th power universes. If the reciprocal of the probability is equal to the number of trials for the event, then that event must appear somewhere. This is a big problem. This is a major problem for theistic science. And how to understand this? There's a way to understand. Although I've gotten way off track by tormenting everyone with unnecessary details, now I will move into the realm of what is easily comprehensible. There are 10 brahmacharis flipping coins. This is easy to understand. And when I flip a coin, the chance is 50% that I get heads. That everyone understands. It's 50% chance that anyone will get heads up. And if two people are flipping, the chance that we both get heads up at the same time is a half times a half is 1 out of 4. So the probability is lower. The more things you want to happen simultaneously, the lower the overall probability is. Does that make sense? Because I'm flipping, and I have a random chance of 1 out of 2 or a half, and you're flipping, you get a half. But that we get it a half, that we both happen to get heads up in the same time is less likely than my probability. And it's actually very simple. You just multiply. So that, because you're flipping and I'm flipping, the probability is 1 out of 4. And then if Bhakti Derek is also flipping, then it's 1 out of 8. And if a Charyanista is also flipping, then it's 1 out of 16. So if you have 10 people flipping coins simultaneously, it's 1 half times itself 10 times. There's 1 over 2 to the 10th, and that's 1 out of 1,000. So the probability that 10 fired up brahmacharis flipping coins will all get heads up at the same time is 1 out of 1,000. So then a theist, a naive theist, will say, oh, it'll never happen. It's impossible. It's too unlikely that we'll all get, that 10 people get heads up at the same time. And that's actually wrong on the part of the theist. Because if you do 1,000 trials, you'll see it one time. The reciprocal of the probability. If the reciprocal of the probability, if the number of trials equals the reciprocal of the probability, then it's actually guaranteed to see that event. Or to be more precise, if you do millions of trials, you'll find that out of every 1,000 trials, one time you will expect to see that. It's not guaranteed. But if you do many, many runs, a large number of runs, you'll notice on the average, you will see it one time out of 1,000. On some runs, it'll be like 990. Or even 980, or even the very first time it's possible to get it. But that's exceedingly unlikely. So you do millions of trials. This is the science of statistics. It's just straight mathematics. It has nothing to do with either theist or atheistic philosophy. See, if you're trying to build a bridge between atheism and theism, you have to take the neutral ground in terms of philosophy and science. You cannot use Bhagavad Gita with the atheists or any scripture. In fact, the Christians have done that. The Christians have tried for many decades. Their conclusion is, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to hell. So that style of preaching is now frowned upon in academia, to put it mildly. That's considered very, very backwoods, like they have the image of some ignorant hick in Mississippi with a shotgun. You don't believe in Jesus, boy, you's going to hell. They have cartoons, the scientists have cartoons. So the Christians have actually defeated themselves. They're actually like us. They're trying to prove the existence of God. They've spent a lot of money. In fact, they've done a lot more than we have done. They have whole giant institutes. In Seattle, they have the Discovery Institute, which is pushing the modern Christian idea called intelligent design. And they have huge funding. They're way ahead of us. They have millions of dollars. The Discovery Institute in Seattle. And in San Diego, there's the Institute for Creation Research. They also have huge funding. In the 1980s, when I first came on board with Sadab Hutabu and Dhrutakarma is a great warrior, a great fighter. He's been fighting for many decades, Dhrutakarma Prabhu, with forbidden archaeology. So I came on board with them in the early 80s. Sadab, it was me, we did the first Origins magazine, Sadab Hutabu, Dhrutakarma Prabhu, and myself. And they were already 10 years in the movement. They're Prabhupada disciples. And I was brand new. So I was just serving them. So we wrote a letter to the Institute for Creation Research. We were based in San Diego. We wrote a letter to them, you know, saying, let's work together as brothers. And they said, you're of the devil. They wrote back a letter. They said, this Hindu creationism you're trying to push is of the devil. The only way you can work with us is to take an oath that you surrender to Jesus Christ. So it was so much for working together. We tried as brothers, let us be brothers. We're all theists. We're all trying to prove the existence of God and defeat this horrendous, you know, the materialistic worldview is just turning people into apes. The official worldview is that you're just a modified ape. The worldview of Christianity in the Renaissance and in the Middle Ages is that we're fallen demigods. We're supposed to, by repentance, we're supposed to purify ourselves and go back to God. Actually, Christianity is the very closest philosophy to our philosophy of all existing philosophies anywhere. It's actually, Bhaktivinoda Thakur called Christianity a kind of neophyte Vaishnavism. And And Jesus Christ was basically devotional, and St. John of the Cross, or St. Joseph of Cupertino, or St. Teresa of Avila, they were very devotional. St. John of the Cross, he called himself the servant of God. He was very humble, and he went around preaching. He was just like a Vaishnava, St. John of the Cross. And same with St. Joseph of Cupertino. They actually developed mystic powers. This is very fascinating subject matter I began reading about. They didn't want it. They were humble. They're really Vaishnavs. This St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, she began floating around the seminary. Is that what you call it? A seminary or convent. She was floating. She was always glorifying God. She was always in ecstasy. She was feeling ecstatic symptoms. All it's exactly like Vaishnava. It's so similar. And how did they get the mystic powers? By they were stopped eating. They did exactly what Raghunath Das Goswami did. It's exactly the same thing. They did penance and austerity. They prayed to God and to Jesus continuously. It was in Spain, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila. They lived in Spain in the winter. They would sleep on the stone floor with no blankets, hard, cold stone floor in the winter time. It's not quite as cold as here, Spain, but it's quite cold. It will get down to in the 40s. And they would sleep on the cold floor. They did austerity. They went out of their way. They didn't try to accumulate bodily comforts. Actually, Krishna told King Muchukunda, this is something fascinating in the Krishna book. He said, when someone is situated in the mixed qualities of passion and ignorance, he's addicted to sense gratification. Even he may aspire for something higher, but he cannot give it up. But when one is in the mode of goodness, he tries to do penances and austerities to purify his existence. They actually had this conception, St. John of the Cross. Although they're totally not in the Vedic system, it's unrelated to our system, but their conception was very similar. This is a great chapter where King Muchukunda, he comes out of the cave, and he noticed that the human species had been reduced to pygmy stature. Everyone remembers reading that? How, when he came out of the cave? And this is interesting because the Darwinists also say that the Pleistocene mammals were larger, but I'm getting off the point. I always get, because there's so many fascinating things we can use in support of our philosophy, but I have to focus back on the original point. The point that we're dealing with here, the difficult point is that the atheists conjure up enough trials to counterbalance the low probability. And we have not defeated this. This is the multiverse theory, and the theists have not yet defeated this. This is a major problem for theism. Even if we go through, using physics, chemistry, or molecular biology, the fruit of the analysis in these fields is a number, the probability of formation of a system, like a bacterium. What is the probability of a bacterium coming together? The probability is so low, even one chemist who has nothing to do with theism. He's an atheistic chemist named Robert Shapiro at New York University. He wrote a book on origins in 1986. He was giving, the probability he said is so low it's worse than 10 to the minus 1,000th power. His estimate, no one has done a rigorous analysis, but his estimate is it's lower than 10 to the minus 1,000th power to get a bacterium. So even if we do all the analysis and we come up with a number, the atheists, they jubilantly conjure up enough universes to equalize it. And then when you object to that, they say, aha, just see, from Mahavishnu is coming, Prabhupada says, their purports, unlimited universes. Asankhya. In Sanskrit, asankhya means uncountable. It may not be strictly infinite. It may be just a very large number. Asankhya means uncountably large, the number of universes. And the Mayavadis even pull out Vedic literatures like the Yoga Vashishta, where Vashishta Muni is speaking to Ramchandra and says some universes are anishvara, anishvara. No, there's no controller. They just have lower creatures. So that really, the atheists, they lick their lips jubilantly as they challenge the Vedic theists. Just see, in your shastras, there are many universes with different life forms progressing. It looks like due to random combination of various elements, some universes you'd expect to find lower creatures. Some universes are devoid of any creatures. In fact, just to get a star requires fine-tuning of the Big Bang. There was one British astrophysicist named Martin Rees, R-E-E-S. He wrote a book called Just Six Numbers. By specifying six numbers in the Big Bang, say the atheists, you can get a universe if the number, if the six numbers are specified precisely enough, and these numbers involve fundamental constants like the ratio of the charge of an electron to the mass of a proton, for example. It's not exactly that, because I haven't studied this. But fundamental values of constants, like the, involving the mass of a proton and the charge of an electron, the strength of the electron, the ratio of the strength of the electromagnetic field to the gravitational field. So it takes six numbers to specify a universe closely enough that you get a star instead of a universe consisting of nothing more than uniform hydrogen gas. The vast majority of universes coming out of a Big Bang would simply be amorphous, having no form, amorphous, no constructions, no forms. It would just be uniform hydrogen gas. If the parameters are fine-tuned precisely enough, then gravity comes into play, and when you have hydrogen gas and gravity, then gradually stars form, because by gravitational attraction, hydrogen forms a star. This is the atheistic scenario, which we have not yet defeated. We must do more research in order to carry out Prabhupada's mandate. Prabhupada was not ambiguous. He said challenge and defeat. In fact, he said kick on their face with boots. If you want to know what Prabhupada actually said, it's radical. There are letters on Vedabase. You should study the Vedabase. Prabhupada was totally radical. He said, kick on their face with a boot. The more you kick on Darwin's face, the more you advance in spiritual life. That's what Prabhupada wrote there. The more you kick on Darwin's face, the more you advance in spiritual life. There's nothing ambiguous about that, about what we're trying to do. The goal is crystal clear, but we haven't done it because science is progressing at a glacial pace, unfortunately. A glacier moves at 1 inch per year, very slow. The phenomena are very difficult. Shukadeva Goswami says in the beginning of the fifth canto, in the beginning of the chapter we're going to get up to describing the universal setup, how the planets are set up. He said, it's so difficult to understand the universal elements. The only person who really understands is Lord Vishnu himself. Brahma just receives seeds. It's called bija. And then Brahma passes off the seeds to other demigods, his sons, Manasaputra. Lord Brahma has many sons. He's so powerful, he produces sons by his mind. Manasa Putra. Putra means son and Manasa means mind. He just creates, simply by his desire. He's empowered by Vishnu. He's not on the level of Vishnu, but because of his avesh, shakti avesh, Brahma can function almost like Vishnu. So Brahma, he produces sons by his mind, great sages like Marichi and Daksha and Angira Muni. And then they produce other demigods called Prajapatis. There's a whole hierarchy of production of species that's described in the Bhagavatam. So our viewpoint is that things move from more sophisticated to less sophisticated. And the scientist's view, the atheistic scientist's view, is that matter has the inherent power of self-organization and moves in the direction of self-organization given enough random events. So this is the dividing line I mentioned a couple days ago. The dividing line between the atheist and theist philosophy is that the atheists say that matter has the inherent capacity to organize itself. And they will point to, if you put salt in water, salt crystals form spontaneous, crystal growth. They will say, aha, there it is. And of course the theist will say, well look, a crystal is very simple. A sodium chloride crystal is a regular alternation of just two atoms, sodium and chlorine. It's not very sophisticated. So the atheist will say, but it's the first step, it's heading in the direction, just see, here we go. Given enough time and given enough events, see, they always appeal to large numbers of trials, and we have not defeated that. Our own scriptures do describe many universes. Asankhya, there's uncountable number of universes. So that's a major problem. I think everyone is beginning to understand what I'm saying, is we have a big problem. And before we can go universe to universe and be digvijaya, dig means direction and vijaya means conquer, which is exactly what Prabhupada wanted us to do, we have to do a lot of research. We have not done the research. Judhakarma has done a heroic research in forbidden archaeology. Forbidden archaeology. I was the original researcher, actually, in 1984. before even Judhakarma began doing the research. Sadaputta put me on that project. But Judhakarma is more intelligent than me, so he took over the project and saw it through. I was too weak. I couldn't concentrate on... It's very austere. If you read, have you seen the book? It's 800 pages. It's full of bones. 800 pages of bones. What bones have been found? Like Australopithecus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus. Has everyone heard of these creatures? These are subhumans moving in the direction of humans, according to the atheists. And according to Judhakarma, these are they're simultaneous lineages. This, according to Vedic epistemology, with Judhakarma is noble. He's the noble defender of the Vedic epistemology. So we have to do a lot of research. We have to do a lot of work. Judhakarma's done a lot in this one field dealing, it's called paleoanthropology, but we have to deal with the rest of the fossil record. The problem is that the non-human species outnumber the human species very greatly by many orders of magnitude. The Western scientists say that, and the Vedas also say that. In the Vedic paradigm, you have a pyramid. There's less Brahmins than Kshatriyas, and there's more Vaishyas than Kshatriyas, and there's more Sudras than Vaishyas. As you go down the scale, and much more animals, there's more cats and dogs, and lesser creatures than Shudras. So if you just take the human fossil record, that constitutes much less than 1% of the total number of fossils that have ever been deposited throughout all of history. So although Judhakarma has done an absolutely wonderful job, he's the best. Many times we devotees think Sadaputta is the greatest science preacher. He's probably the most brilliant in terms of insight, and his writings are the most comprehensive, but Judhakarma is the most tenacious. Everyone knows the word tenacious. He never gave up. He just kept on going. Judhakarma was given lectures all over the planet in many countries. And he's done a tremendous job trying to defeat this materialistic, atheistic self-organization worldview. But because forbidden archaeology, although 800 pages and one of the best things that has ever been produced in theistic archaeology, theistic science, certainly one of the greatest things ever published in ISKCON, and although massive and voluminous, citing so many analyses, it deals with only less than 0.01% of the entire fossil record. What about the other portions of the fossil record? The atheists, again, they greedily lick their lips. It's like Mahabharata, you know, Duryodhana scheming to get rid of the Pandavas. It's exactly like that. It's a fight. It's the classic scenario. The fight between theists and atheists now has moved into the classroom. It used to be on the battlefield. Jarasandha, he would come out. Jarasandha would assemble 18 Akshauhinis and come to Dvarka. Come to Mathura. Surround Mathura with 18 Akshauhinis and challenge Krishna and Balaram. Krishna and Balaram would nonchalantly stroll out onto the battlefield with an insignificant number of warriors and annihilate all of Jarasandha's forces. 17 times. So in the old days, when the demons, they would challenge Krishna directly to combat, Poundraka, he sent a letter to Krishna. In Dvarka, he said, "You're not actually Krishna. You look like Krishna, but you're not Krishna. I'm Krishna." He did render indirect devotional service because all the members of the Yadu dynasty were laughing. They were all cracking up and enjoying. This Poundraka, he's an amazing person. He was dead serious. He became dead, literally dead. He was dead serious. He wrote a letter. This is Krishna book. Everyone should read the Krishna book. We should know Krishna book like the back of your hand, like this chapter with Muchukunda coming out of the cave in Kalayavana. We should know this is our tradition, this is our heritage, is the great Vaishnav Shastras. So this Poundraka, he's the epitome of illusion or arrogance or foolishness. I guess foolishness is the major characteristic. He was totally serious. Somehow in his mind he had reached the conclusion that he was Vasudev. He reached that conclusion and so he sent a letter to Dvarka. He said, "I'm actually Vasudev, one of the expansions of Krishna. You're not Krishna. You look like Krishna, but you're not Krishna. And I challenge you to a fight. Come and let's have a fight, and the matter will be decided." So after they got up from rolling on the floor in laughter, Krishna said, all right, let's challenge this guy. So they went to Kashi, and there was a big fight, and everyone knows the result, of course. Actually, Krishna said, you wanted my chakra, because Pandraka demanded the chakra. So Krishna said, all right, I'm going to give you the chakra, but it's coming a little faster than you had anticipated. So he demanded the four symbols of Vishnu, especially the chakra, and the chakra made him one head shorter. So that was the old style. The old style is you challenge Vishnu to a fight, Hiranyaksha. That's what he did. He found Lord Varaha, and he said, you're actually afraid of me. This is far out. It's in the third canto, chapter 19, third canto. Varaha was doing his duty and picking up the earth planet, because the demons had Hiranya means gold. The demons were so much interested in getting gold that they actually put the earth out of its gravitational balance, and it fell down into the Garbhadak ocean. This is another thing. If you go to university, they're going to say this is utter mythology. So we have, this is another, everywhere you look on the pages of Bhagavatam, we have a massive challenge. Here's what it says in the third canto. Hiranyaksha was drilling for gold, and by drilling so much gold out, he made the earth go out of its gravitational balance, and it fell down into the Garbhadak ocean. Now this is a big problem, because if you go to Australia, which is on the other side of the earth, you don't see any ocean down below. You look like you're looking up wherever you go on the earth. And gravity is heading towards the center of the earth. There's no universal down in the planetary. This is another thing. Everywhere you look in the Bhagavatam, we have a massive challenge. Devotees would bloop, Sadaputta told me. In 1975, when the fifth canto came out, many devotees blooped. They ran away from the temple, the New York temple. When Sadaputta first joined, he listened to the lecture Prabhupada gave, there are rivers of nectar on the moon. If this is false, all the Vedas are false. And Sadaputta said, wow, we got a big job ahead of us. The rivers of mango juice. There are giant mangoes falling, and they hit jagged rocks, and there were rivers of mango juice on the moon. We have a lot of work to do. And the atheists, they jubilantly lick their lips and they say, okay, you guys say we never went to the moon. Forget about going to the moon. Take a telescope. When I was little, when I was 6 years old, my father bought me a telescope. You crank up the magnification and the moon comes up. It gets bigger and bigger, and all you see is rocks and dust. What to speak of going there? Simply by magnification. So someone might say, the Catholic Church said that Galileo's telescope lied. It's not going to do. We can't use that kind of reasoning anymore. That's why they subjected Galileo to the Inquisition. He was tried. He was put into great difficulty because he claimed that there are other bodies that are not orbiting the earth. So he was subjected, and they said his telescope lied. But if you take the telescope apart, it's just a few lenses put together just like the glasses you're using to read the Bhagavatam. So are your glasses lying? Well, you can check. You can bring over a friend who doesn't wear glasses, and he reads the same thing as you do. Or you can set up the telescope in the back of the temple room and crank up the magnification and look at the jewelry on the deities, and then you can ask the pujari who is actually addressing the deities and confirm that the telescope is not lying. And then you just turn the telescope upward. It's the very same telescope that you've just ascertained has accurately reproduced what the deities are wearing, and you just point the telescope upward. And you look at the moon and you increase the magnification systematically, and the moon gets large. I did it when I was a kid. The moon gets bigger and bigger. And you see rocks and dust. There's no atmosphere. There's a sharp dividing line between the horizon of the moon. There's no atmosphere. Exactly what the scientists say. So it will not do to simply say that the telescope lied. That explanation will not find favor in academia or even among common people. We have a lot of homework to do, is my simple point, in order to carry out Prabhupada's mandate. So if your mind is not peaceful enough to wave the chamara fan in front of Sri Sri Kishore Kishori, or you can't distribute books like me, if you're too fallen and have no love for the other, for conditioned souls, but your mind is overactive, it's constantly working day and night, I can give you research projects to do, and this is much needed. This is a greatly needed service. You'll also get the mercy. Book distribution is the best. If you can do book distribution, simply do that and forget about everything else. Fix your mind. There's a letter quote it as you go up the staircase. Fix your mind. Do not divert your mind from this for a second. Book decision is the best service. But there are many people who cannot do it, actually. It requires purity and dedication and love and compassion. All the nobler sentiments that are devoid in my particular psychology. And there are many other people, like they're grad students at colleges, and they're a little bit puffed up and they can't do book distribution. But they can still get the mercy of Prabhupada. Prabhupada wanted this. So, in fact, you know what Prabhupada wrote? It's April 2nd, 1977, letter to Rameshwar, who was the head of the BBT. He said, I will give you $10,000 a month. And the whole Juhu temple had just been the most opulent temple in ISKCON. In fact, then Prabhupada said, I will give you more than 10,000 if you need more. 10,000 a month. So that was April 2nd, 1977. I grew up in the 50s, so I bought gas in 77 for 40 cents a gallon. It's now $4, 10 times. So that's $100,000 a month. Not bad. Prabhupada wanted to give. $100,000 a month, he told Swoop Dabinder Marsh, who was head of the BI, Bhaktan Institute, to go forth and challenge. And before you can go forth and challenge, you have to have your weapons and your astras, which means we have to do our research. Because I just mentioned in the course of this class, in the fossil record, we have a massive amount of work. In astronomy, we have a huge amount of work. And even worse, in molecular biology and chemistry, self-organization of matter, we have a massive, huge challenge. What to speak of Big Bang? I also mentioned Big Bang, fine-tuning, universal fine-tuning to produce universes from a Big Bang. And of course, the theists will say, the Big Bang, that's ridiculous. Big Bang Construction Company. The devotees put out one record. Big Bang, I'm going to build your house. It's the Big Bang. You pull up with a van at your house. We're called Big Bang Construction Company. We have 5 pounds of TNT, and we throw the logs on the ground, and we blow it up with the TNT, and there's your house forming. So that's the theist. That's how the theists attack the Big Bang. That's not going to do, because the way the origin of the Big Bang, according to the atheists, is it comes from a quantum vacuum fluctuation, and the quantum field is just like the Vedic Pradhan. Actually, the demons study our scriptures and use it against us. This is another thing we have to understand. Most of science is actually from the Germans, and the Germans study the Vedas. Hitler had a massive research project to translate Vedas. Even NASA, even the U.S. Space Administration. Everyone is fascinated by the Vedas. The Vedas are actually superior knowledge. So what do the Vedas say? What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita chapter 7, text 4? Bina prakriti ashtada. These eight separated elements. Earth, water. And that's another problem, because Earth in your backyard has a different chemical composition from the Earth in my backyard. So that's, and then the atheists greedily lick their lips and jubilantly challenge. What do you mean the Earth as an element? How can it be a fundamental element? Earth has a different composition. It looks different in my backyard. It's dark brown. In your backyard, it's light brown. It has more silicon. And in my backyard, it has more iron, so it's dark brown. How can you say Earth is a fundamental element? This is another problem. Everywhere you turn in the Bhagavatam, Banasura with 1,000 arms. How can you honestly expect me to believe that someone has 1,000 arms? Is this to be taken literally? So then we have to respond by doing research. It can be dealt with. These issues can be dealt with. Like in quantum mechanics and higher dimensional space, these issues can be dealt with. But we haven't done it. This is a major research project. That's why, and in this letter, April 2nd, 77, Prabhupada said, this is our most important preaching arm with which we will defeat this bogus speculation that goes under the banner of modern science. Our most important preaching arm, he said. And he said, now we can disband the Sanskrit department. He wrote to Rameshwar, April 2nd, 1977. It's in the Veda base. You can read the letter. Rameshwar was the head of the BBT. We can disband the Sanskrit department and the art department. Prabhupada was ready to cut down all the beautiful pictures. Prabhupada said, no more pictures. We don't need any more pictures. He told the BBT, we cut out the art department and the Sanskrit department. We're going for science. This was Prabhupada's ultimate conclusion. After book distribution was established by the middle 70s, in the 74 and 75, Prabhupada was going temple to temple, encouraging the devotees to distribute. By 77, just before he left the planet, book distribution was roaring and rolling. They were doing 6 million books a year. There's a book called Servant of the Servant. The stats are given. 6 million books a year in 1975 were distributed. 6 million pieces of literature. Even just among Bhagavad Gitas, it was close to 1 million Bhagavad Gitas a year. There were not as many temples as nowadays. Devotees were simply on fire. So Prabhupada's greatest desire was book distribution. But after that was in place, then by 77, the devotees who traveled with Prabhupada more than anyone else, like Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Hari Sari, who was Prabhupada's servant for 18 months, he lasted longer than any other personal servant of Prabhupada. His name is Hari Sari. I think everyone has heard of Hari Sari Prabhu. He wrote the beautiful Transcendental Diary. He writes in the Transcendental Diary, he says again and again, Prabhupada is talking about science. More than any other subject in the last 2 years, 76 and 77, Prabhupada left on 14th November, 77. He departed from this world. So Prabhupada's main focus in the last 2 years of his life, again and again, he was saying, we have to defeat the science. We have to defeat the science. In our movement, there were only three PhDs, Sadaputta, Madhava Prabhu, and Bhakti Srup Damodar Maharaj. There are only three PhDs, and everyone should recognize from what I'm saying here that the work requires hundreds of PhDs. In the class that I've been giving now, I'm just giving an overview. It's like a smorgasbord of a little taste of here and there and the difficulties and challenges involved in theistic presentation. Hundreds of PhDs. If 100 PhDs walked in the room at this moment, I could give them projects. I have many projects I'm writing up now. I'm writing a whole book. I have unlimited ideas based on Prabhupada's instructions. But I'm only one human being, and I'm not even very good in science. I'm a failure in book distribution. I'm also a failure in science. So I'm a total failure in far as devotional service goes. So we need to organize. If I can organize before I leave my body, we need a team of hundreds of scientists, because the scientists have, there are thousands of universities, and if you add up Europe and America alone, where the homeland of atheism is Europe and America, Westerners, the German scientists, they're the expert. They're so expert, they use the Vedas, I'd say, many universes. They just pull out our own stuff and use it against us, as I explain in the class. So if you add up America alone, Parmeshri goes college to college. Probably he does 200-300 universities. And he won't even touch a university with less than 20,000 students. So that's 200 in America. And then there's 200 of those in Europe. And then in each university, there's dozens of scientists. They literally have tens of thousands of scientists. We can't even get 100 PhDs together. How are we going to compete against them? So this is for non-book. This class is for non-book distributors. Those who are book distributors, just do your thing. Focus. Do not divert your attention. But actually, when you meet, this is something you can do, because you go to the colleges all the time. Parmeshra is sending me emails, actually, of students, physics students and chem students. So this is something you can do. If you get an email of someone who is a scientist, just send it in my direction. I'll give everyone my email. You just send me the person, and then we're trying to get a whole institute together, because it's not the work of one man. Just from what I've said, it's massive research. In paleontology alone, they have hundreds of thousands of bones. They will probably have to take birth as a lower creature. They're only interested in bones, like a dog is interested in bones. But see, they're dead serious. They're running full speed ahead with atheism. It's escalating. Atheism is escalating in the intellectual spheres. So just send me anyone who's favorable, or at least neutral, then I can try to get them on board this project. And now, of course, because I always go over time, I apologize to the assembled Vaishnavs. Are there any questions or challenges or corrections? Or rotten tomatoes at high speed? When the audience has a difference of opinion, you can bring a can of rotten tomatoes in the back for aiming at the speaker. Or better yet, you put the Vyasan on wheels and you just scoot it out the door. In San Diego, they have a Vyasan on wheels, and when they don't like the speaker, they just just give a quick nudge and it goes running right out onto Grand Avenue.
For your class. So my question is, it's like a two-part question. Basically, suppose we defeat this multiverse theory. Suppose we defeat Darwinism. Suppose we defeat all these other major theories that the atheist scientists have. It seems to me that their atheism is inspiring these theories. The Christians giving them the intelligence to come up with newer and newer things. So until we defeat their atheism, they'll always come up with something else. It seems that they, you know, once you defeat this, then their atheism will inspire them to come up with something else. And so my question is really, it seems like it would be very difficult to prove that the living entities came out of, you know, Lord Brahma's mind. And
I disagree, because matter can do certain things and cannot do other things. It's not futile. You're presenting the view, if I understand your position, that it's futile. Everyone knows the word futile?
No, that's not what I was saying.
Isn't that what you're saying? It's my point to use science, to use scientific evidence is a mistake. Is that... I'm just trying to understand
I was more saying, I'm trying to say suppose we disprove a theory, then they're going to look at us, okay, now can you prove what you are claiming?
Well, I will show you how you do it. If you can show that there's only 10 to the 40th power universes, if you can prove, just, and it's a matter of what matter can and can, I made the point in class, the matter can do some things and it cannot do other things. It's not arbitrary. There's one leg of religion left. There's four legs in Satya Yuga. One leg is truth. They're still interested in, I mean, really it's eroding rapidly, but they have debates, and quantum mechanics was at first not accepted. It was a revolution. Revolutions occur in science. You can disprove a ruling paradigm. You can force them to give up their views if you have strong enough evidence. That's my point. If you have strong enough evidence, you can force them by the power of logic. Of course, they'll try to avoid it and use the underhanded tricks. And forbidden archaeology is full of underhanded tricks, like they took away a microscope of one researcher when she found something that didn't fit in. Forbidden archaeology is a great book. Everyone should read it. And it goes to a deeper... Forbidden archaeology makes a deeper point of epistemology, namely that there's a knowledge filter, and scientists ignore evidence that goes against them. So Drudhakara makes an excellent case for that. But there are cases in science when the evidence is overwhelmingly strong, they're forced to accept it. And for example, North American archaeology, people, they're starting to gradually come around that man appeared in North America earlier than was previously recognized. So when the evidence becomes overwhelmingly strong, it forces a paradigm shift. Although they will use underhanded tricks, like trying to get rid of them. They're a professor at some university and make them be fired from their position as a professor. Get them fired. There's certainly underhanded tricks involved in the game, but that only involves a small shift in chronology. If North American archaeology has shifted to accepting human beings 400,000 years ago in North America, it still doesn't destroy the overall paleoanthropological picture of Australopithecus Homo habilis. They would just readjust. They would rescale it. They would push it a little back further. So what is required, instead of pointing out their underhandedness, which is certainly true, there's the Piltdown case was deliberate fraud, Piltdown in archaeology. I think devotees have not studied this, paleoanthropology, in great detail. So we'll have to do more than simply point to fraud and imperfect senses. We need something better than that. We need more hard data in our arsenal. And I'm suggesting at least we should try to get that hired. If we can't, we can use what you're suggesting. We can use epistemological arguments that they have a warped philosophy. They refuse to acknowledge bona fide evidence even when it's presented. Knowledge filter, that's what Drudhakara uses, the knowledge filter. That's a strategy also, but I would suggest a superior strategy is to defeat them by using evidence. It can be done. Well, how to do it? Okay, so you're asking how to do it. Suppose we could show that the Big Bang, the way the quantum vacuum fluctuations work in producing Big Bangs is they could only produce 10 to the 40th power universes that have anything more than uniform hydrogen gas in them. And then we also show that the probability of the formation of a self-replicating system, and you can't even use a bacterium because there are simpler systems that replicate that could have started evolution. A bacterium is the simplest autonomously self-replicating system in biology that is known, but there are much simpler systems, purely chemical systems, the atheists say, that we have to defeat. So we have to show that, suppose you could do a calculation that the simplest self-replicating system that could appear had a probability of 10 to the minus 500th power of coming about. And then you show that the maximum number of universes is 10 to the 40th power, then they're ruined, because there's a giant disparity between the available number of trials and the reciprocal of the probability of evolution. That's how you defeat them. There's a straightforward strategy for defeating them. And because of time constraints, see, we're at 8:45. I know that what I said was too quick. Some people are looking with a dazed and bewildered look on their face. And because I've brutally left out many details, but to fill in the details would require so much background time. When I did seminars in Poland, we took many weeks to cover all the issues. For someone who knows, the problem is devotees have no training in science. So I have to translate, as a running in my mind, I have to back off and translate back to basic concepts, which actually I'm happy to do, but the amount of time it would take is prohibitive in a Bhagavatam format, and all of you have many services to perform, especially you book distributors shouldn't. I'm probably going to hell because I've kept the book distributors from going out on book distribution. There's a special hellish world which is being created for me right now. Yamaraj is arranging a particular scenario. Which one of the 23 hellish regions does one have to visit for holding up the Sankirtan Yajna? There's 23. We're going to get to it in the fifth canto, the hellish planets. That's another whole problem. See, when you talk about hell, the scientists, they begin... You can just imagine what people say nowadays. If we're presenting hell as literal. There are literally planets where people are punished. If you try, go to a university and try to present this. You should understand the great challenges we have to presenting Krishna consciousness in modern society. We should inundate the world with books. But after that, once people have the books and they read these things, they go, what is this? Hellish planets? I thought that went out with the Bible. In the Ozarks you have with a shotgun, you know, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to hell, boy. See, that's the Christian image. But we're saying we have it even more radical. They don't even describe what hell is all about. We have 23, no less than 12, 23 hellish planets where it's described in great detail. Kumbhipaka, that means cooking pot. If you throw a lobster in boiling water like all these people do, they go to the restaurant, they throw the lobster alive in the boiling water, there's a hellish planet just waiting for you where the Yamduts cook you up royally. There's even there's teams of Yamduts. Do you know what people would say at a university if you try to present it today? This is mythology. This is nonsense. What's the word? It's like reactionary. It's like we got rid of this. This is the Dark Ages. This is the religious repression that kept people in a stupid condition of life. In the Middle Ages in Europe, we revolted. We got rid of all that stuff. Demons and witches and ghouls and werewolves. And goblins, hobgoblins. That's Halloween. You expect me to believe this stuff? You don't understand because devotees don't go to... The only outreach we have is book distribution. We don't have any preachers who confront this atheistic worldview head on. We have not met this challenge that Prabhupada wanted. Neither have we produced self-sufficient farm communities. The only thing we're doing is book distribution, which is the best thing. But in many other respects, Prabhupada's instructions for self-sufficient farm communities, we haven't done that. And intellectual conquest in the academic sphere, that's our worst failure. Because it's the greatest challenge. We tried. Sadhaputta tried. They tried, honestly. I'm not finding fault with anyone. I'm the worst. I'm the most delinquent. But I'm just saying we have a massive amount of work. If you can't be a book distributor, this is what you should do. If you be a book distributor, just go off and get all glories from Guru and Gauranga. This class was for non-book distributors. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Nope.